Blog Talk Radio. Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends, Chuck Thurston and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Good morning, Paula.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning. Hey. Marvin is visiting grandchildren today. Yay! It's one of the best things that a person can do, if you ask me. So I hope he's having a great time. That's right,
yeah,
isn't
just
it?
I'm the only one of the hosts that doesn't have grandchildren now. How about that?
Well, it's coming soon, Andre.
You think?
I think. You know, our friends Buck and Arlene Weimer, they were about to give up, and then all of a sudden it happened, and now they have their beautiful little granddaughter in their life, and oh man, is she a gorgeous child. So yeah. I know that gives them such delight. And you know, Arlene especially, she and I had conversations about it many times. So what a wonderful thing seeing that is. And gosh, Chuck, I was on Facebook looking at Angie's pictures of Orion, and what a darling child. Oh my God.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
He's so cute.
Yeah,
literally a star child. Literally a star child.
So much expression in his face, you know. It's just like whatever he's feeling is just all right there. It's so cute.
Yeah.
Man,
yeah,
I can't wait.
I noticed, too, how he makes people smile.
Yeah, how could you not smile when you look at his face?
The grown-ups, you know, interacting with him are all just like, oh.
they're all gaga. Children are like that, though. I mean, and the older I get, the more I appreciate them in general. You know, I think that's true. For all of us, the older we get, the more we appreciate little children and their innocence and their beauty. And it's pretty special.
Well, they kind of help us realize that we're still pretty early on ourselves.
Yeah, right.
The cosmic scheme of things.
They help us to remember to take wonder in simple things, too. You know, and we start to see things through their eyes, and that's such a gift. May Lee did that for Glenn and I. And we were both, you know, close to 40. I was 41 and he was 39 when we got May in China.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we started seeing everything through her eyes. And it was such a gift, you know. Things we thought were silly, like Barney, all of a sudden became much more meaningful.
Oh,
beautiful.
You lived through the Barney years, huh? Okay.
Oh, yeah. And we used to hold her and hug her together, and we'd sing to her Barney's family song, I love you, you love me, we're a happy family, with a great big kiss and a hug from me to you, won't you say you love me too? And we'd sing that to her, and she'd get this silly little heart smile on her face. It was so, so cute.
Oh,
and,
boy.
You know, yeah, she'd get all perclamped.
Oh, those are great memories. Those
are
great memories. Wonderful.
Yeah. So anyway, I hope that's in your life soon, Andre, because I know how much you'll cherish that. As fun as being a parent is, being a grandparent is really a blast.
Right. It's all the fun and none of the mess. Yeah.
That's true. And not the responsibility unless you're babysitting,
that's,
you know. So.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I just realized I do kind of have, I have a surrogate grandchild in a weird kind of a way, not a weird way, in a very nice way. And when I went to the Philippines on behalf of Your Rancho Book Fellowship and the International Fellowship Committee, it's just a couple of years ago now, Chuck. Heck, it's 2 years ago that you and I had Thanksgiving dinner at a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Yeah, that was great.
That was awesome.
That was. I loved that. That was so fun.
Too.
Yeah.
Did you have a Chinese turkey?
No, there was not a gobble in the group in any of the food. No. No gobbling except for the gobbling we did. But, it, you know, just ahead of that, I'd been in the Philippines, and we went up a hill to see where some of our Filipino readers were living. And, you know, you have to just imagine some of the poverty that's there in the Philippines, and there they had, you know, essentially a concrete hut and with a tarpaulin, you know, plastic tarpaulin roof for part of it. I mean, this is a rainy country, and one of the children of the friends of some of our student reader friends was a little girl by the name of Ashley Millenom. And Ashley, this is a long story in a certain sense, so I'll try to shorten it up. But in the Philippines, it's very, very common. Anybody who's 2 years older than you or more, there are signs of respect that are shown to those that are older than you. And it was very, very quick that the reader friends, Carissa, I'll name the name Carissa Sunga, you know, she started calling me Tito, which means uncle. Well, her friend Ashley started calling me Lolo, which is grandfather.
Awesome.
And I realized, okay, I truly am. I guess I've crossed the Rubicon because that stuck. And, you know, over the last 2 years, we've kept in touch over Facebook Messenger, and not just the reader friends, but Ashley has, and she still calls me Lolo or Granfa.
Aww.
And so that's my, I am unofficially a grandpa.
That's wonderful. That reminds me of Larry and Larry Watkins and his relationship with Angel John, who is an Indian reader. He'd study with her twice a week on Zoom, and she always called him grandpa. And she has such an affection for him, such a deep affection. Of course, Larry left our world a few years back, but Angel John, I know their relationship was just wonderful for him because he was one of these people that the Urantia book actually, the fact that he read the Urantia book ended up ruining all of his relationships because his wife was a fundamental Christian and she turned his children against him. And so, you know, Angel John was very special to Larry, you know, and to be called grandpa, I know that meant so much to him.
So if it never happens otherwise, I at least have my apple, my little granddaughter. Yeah.
Your honorary granddaughter.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, gosh, you guys, here we are in the middle of a study of paper 55, The Spheres of Light and Life. And it's been such a great study. And it's so like any Urantia paper where once you start digging in, there's just so much to think about and to explore and to discover and to mine for meaning, as our old friend Steve McIntosh would like to say. And, you know, we've gone through the first six sections. And this is actually a longer paper. It's one of the longer ones, I would think. Wouldn't you say so?
Yeah, it's fairly long, especially because of this last section, which is actually a fairly long section that really tries to treat these various stages of light and life. But now from the standpoint, and this is what's very interesting, is, you know, we're given the stages of light and life earlier for a planet. And they tell us some of the things that will happen on a planet. But then they give us these stages that take wider and wider regions within the local universe. And that's quite remarkable that they treat it in both ways, as though there's something other than, I mean, when you treat the wider area, there's something more to be realized. Well, it's not obvious at first, but, you know, the thing that strikes me is how that's one of the authenticating features of the Urantia book, that there is essentially a cross-referencing, a looking at it from another angle that is being done. Because it's a reality. It's
invaluable,
it's something,
really.
It's something that can be looked at from different angles, and so they treat it that way. And they, when you treat it from the different angle, it's consistent. It focuses in on it in such a way that looking at it from the different angle, it doesn't look like something completely different. You understand the correspondence with the previous thing that you were studying. So I know that that's a little bit strange to state it in exactly this way, but I think you get what I mean. It's this idea.
Totally
that,
get it.
Yeah, we're talking about the stages for a planet, but now you can look at it from the standpoint of stages of the entire, each larger unit, the planet, the local system, the constellation, the local universe, the minor sector, major sector, super universe, and then they speculate about what it might mean for the entire grand universe to be settled in light and life, and what that what that might entail. So, yeah, marvelous stuff.
Yeah. Well, in an interesting way, I think what they're kind of mapping out here is an evolution of identity. in the previous section, we read about the individual mortal. And there we can see how mortal evolution for individuals is uplifted and progressed by these stages of light and life. And now in these last few papers, we're going to see how the planet kind of evolves in parallel into later stages of light and life. But what I'm kind of getting by these, you know, I'm really curious to read these sections because I want to get a clearer idea of what they mean by planetary stage, system stage, that sort of thing. But my guess is, or the feeling I have about it, is that it has to do with an increasing sense of identity of the planet itself. The planet, instead of identity, you know, like here on this planet, we don't even know that there's life in the rest of the universe, right? So the planetary life on Urantia at the moment is almost exclusively self-identified. It doesn't have any external reference of belonging.
That's such a good point.
Whereas,
and so important to remember.
About, So I think what they're going to introduce us here is to how planetary life begins to identify with these larger and larger frames of universe life, which inevitably is going to uplift the culture of the planet to those levels, to the extent that that's actually, you know, that communication is made somehow. I'm not sure.
Your
how
word
that
mapping
happens,
is apropos because they are giving us a roadmap essentially, in so many ways. To Andre's point, you know, the planetary mortal epics, and then, you know, this paper. And they focus in on it from different points of view, and it's so internally consistent. It doesn't vary wildly like some other, you know, things you read that you know, were compiled over a long period of time, like the Bible, for instance. It varies so greatly from one you know, book to the next. And it can be confusing. You're like, well, wait a minute. You just said this in the last section, and now you're saying this. I don't get it. And you know, I'll give you a perfect example. For me, in the very first book, you know, it talks about Genesis and how God toiled in the soil and made Adam and Eve and created them and all of that. And then a couple of sections or chapters later, it says, "And let us set men and women forth upon the earth." And, you know, and then we know that Adam and Eve's children went out into the land of Nod and took him a wife. And you're like, well, wait a minute now. Where did she come from? You know, and what about this other creation story? And which one, you know, and what is it? And that's to be expected when you take a collection of the best thinking over a long period of time. And it's going to vary wildly because the people who wrote those, you know, those stories don't necessarily jive with the New Testament or whatever. But with the Urantia book, it's a work that was, you can tell that it was just done by a group of beings who had a plan. And they have an understanding of reality. And what I've been thinking about a lot lately is the cosmos and how they gave us this vision of the cosmos, knowing that our science was getting us to a place where we're now going to discover it, like the Hubble telescope, right? And so they gave us, you know, and I think to your point, Chuck, that alone is such an essential bit of knowledge. You are a member of the cosmos. Your planet is just as lovingly fostered as any other planet. A member of a cosmic family. This is you. This is where you're at. This is who you are. This is what you belong to. It's a gigantic enterprise, bigger than you ever imagined. And we're going to show it to you. And we need that because we are a part of that cosmos. We can't stay in isolation forever. We have to come back into the fold. You know, we are the lost sheep. This planet is the lost sheep. And they're in the process of bringing us back to the fold and helping us understand who we are, how we fit in, how we came to be out of step in the first place.
it makes sense to me that the Rancher book presents a lot of information and instruction about administrative affairs in the universe, the orders of being, and even in this section, what we're about to read, these different levels of universe life. But particularly all the administrative detail, like the types of beings that rule, different administrative subunits of reality. I mean, from one perspective, a person could look at all that and say, well, that's just, tedious or whatever. But on the other hand, it's appropriate to the scale of things. It's appropriate to what you see if you just look up in the sky at night on a clear night. There's something big going on. And that could only be managed, created and managed effectively by an equivalent scale of administrative overcontrol. So that's one of the things I actually respect about the Rancher book, is it posits the administrative concept that's equal to the astronomical concept, if that makes sense.
That totally makes sense.
Yeah, the idea that this could be a wind it up and let it go cosmos that doesn't have any kind of management to it is a fantastical idea, but it certainly conduces more to a dystopian universe than it does to a cosmos that has any potential of being friendly to humanity. And that's the real revelation here. We have a cosmos that is friendly to all persons. And that's a remarkable revelation right there.
Yeah.
I know, isn't that true?
Yeah. It's also personal, too. And even just the bringing into existence of energy, matter and energy in the universe, the detail they give us about that and the beings that are involved. Here's a good plot of empty space over here. Let's, like the story of the Andromeda Nebula, which is kind of the core of Nebadon in a sense, astronomically. Just the story of how that was done. It didn't just happen. It was kind of triggered or enabled or made to happen or brought into reality, by real beings with real intentions. And even though the material processes of physics that take over when something like that is initiated may seem kind of chaotic or random, even there are, there's laws, physical laws in the universe that kind of, again, provide an overcontrol for how those things unfold. But at the same time, there's all these crazy things that happen in space, galaxies collide and huge bodies run, even the story of the formation of our solar system. With that, something came by very closely and pulled matter away from the sun, and that created some of the planets. And, I mean, you just go, wow, this is really something.
And the way they describe it is so fascinating. And I think that future generations, check the things that we might find tedious, future generations will probably go, wow, this is fascinating. They become more intellectual and they can see the patterns more clearly. They'll get things out of it that we can't even imagine now. And we can appreciate it very much, but they will appreciate it at a whole different level.
No doubt.
Yeah, that's amazing to think about. And it's amazing
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, you said, I think we experienced that too. I mean, that's one of the things I love about doing the show, is because it's the opportunity to dig a little deeper into some of this material.
Right.
And whenever I do, it's like, oh, okay. Oh, wow. Yeah, that lines up with that. Well, that makes sense. You start getting new insights about, how it's all put together. Like the ministries of the infinite spirit, how they function on different universe levels. You have seraphim, and then you have these super angels at the highest levels, and all kinds of beings in between. And so many of them are just so fascinating, and they all have a role to play. They all have a piece in the picture, something important that's that's contributed, just like our own contribution is going to be so important to the Supreme, eventually.
It's an amazing thing to contemplate that they've been waiting for us to get to the point where we can withstand what they have to say. You know, I mean, it not only withstand it, but begin to comprehend it, because in many ways we couldn't have comprehended this at all 200 years ago. What are they talking about?
Yeah, probably not.
You know, but knowledge of, but science, and as Pat Yesh pointed out, psychology and the various, the knowledge that we've acquired in even just the last 150 years has enabled us to be able to understand what they're trying to tell us. And I love to tell New Age audiences, and I've introduced them. You know, they're very much into UFOs and ufology and, you know, lessons from the Pleiadians, and people from other planets are trying to reach us and give us knowledge and wisdom, and isn't that great? And yet they go down this rabbit hole of dark aliens who want to take over the world and enslave us on a prison planet. I mean, some of the things get really out there. And I love to tell them, look, you know, you guys, if that were true, if that was going to happen, then why did they wait till now to do it? If the universe was going to, you know, enslave us and take us over, if some evil alien planet was waiting to make slaves of us, why did they wait till now when we have a technology where we can almost mount a defense against them? Why not do it 1,000 years ago when we were, you know, pretty much going everywhere on foot and, you know, using horse and buggy, and we had no weaponry, really. Spears, you know, spears aren't going to do much against invading spaceships. I mean, why wait until now? And they always get this look on their face.
Because it's not as good a story.
They always get this look on their face like, huh, she's got a point. And I've had them come to me at the booth at the expo and tell me, oh, I was just up in Sean David Morton's lecture, and, man, he is just so negative. It's just like everything's bad. Oh, we're doomed. Everything's terrible. I got to come down and talk to you guys. You always make me feel better. I was like, yeah, okay, let's talk about this in reality. Are we really in such a sorry state?
No.
And that nobody cares about us, and we're just out there like a pinball to be buffeted around by the universe. And, you know, is that what we really believe, that we live in a disordered, chaotic, evil empire kind of a universe? And the Arantia book clearly says no, and I think sometimes that's almost, that news is too good for people. It's like, oh, I want to believe that, but I can't. You know,
there are dark forces at work and have been on this planet. It's not like that doesn't exist, but it's not of the type that they imagine, because they don't have a way of imagining what's the reality of it, which it involves superhuman or celestial beings. You know, that's been mitigated to some extent, but still the intuition about that, or the history of that, on the science, there's nothing real there. There's something there that's real that maybe they're picking up intuitively, but they're misinterpreting it or putting it on to what they can conceive of, which is, you know, extraterrestrials flying around in spaceships, right? Which isn't really what's going on.
Right.
It's the whole thing about celestial personality or superhuman personality and all these different levels of being. That's been largely forgotten in the culture of the planet. I mean, they must have had a pretty good idea about it, you know, back in the day, you know, Adam and Eve and planetary parents and all that. That knowledge was brought to the planet, and it survived a little bit in Christianity with knowledge of angels, and other traditions too recognize angels in some sense. But nowadays, people, for the most part, don't take that very seriously, shall we say, let alone God, you know, for that matter.
Right.
So that's, I think, for me, that was the huge contribution of the Arantia book, was just introducing me to the concept of celestial life. like, wow, okay.
And the concept of perfection and what it's like.
Yeah.
To perfect.
Right. There's an ascension. There's an ascension opportunity.
Right.
Yeah.
To be impervious to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think of the Desiderata, which I want to shout out to Karen, who's on the board today. Hi, Karen. She and I discovered we have so much in common, and we both love the Desiderata. And it's a poem by Max Ehrman, and it's from the early 20th century. So I would say he was inspired, certainly. But one of the lines is, he says, "Nurture strength of spirit to shield you in sudden misfortune, but do not distress yourself with dark imaginings. Many fears are born of fatigue and loneliness." You know, I first read this when I was 16 years old, and it became my life philosophy before the Urantia book. It was like the most profound philosophy I'd ever seen, and I said, this is in my heart. In fact, I did this speech at my graduation in high school, and I quoted it several times. "You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here." And, you know, it's just so positive and beautiful. And I do think that people distress themselves with dark imaginings. And they give more power to things than they should, you know.
Mm. Well, what you just read about fear and loneliness, that's so true.
Oh, yeah. Many of those things are born of fear and loneliness. And I can't tell you how many times that comes back to me. Is this fear founded, or is it a dark imagining? Is it, useless anxiety, as the Urantia book would say, that I need to just abandon because it's not at all serving me? And I think mothers tend to go there probably a lot. And this world, let's face it, this world is hard, and it makes us, you know, just not trust that everything's going to be okay. It's just
hard.
Yeah,
we have a strong worry instinct.
Yeah, especially with our precious loved ones in it.
Yeah, particularly as a parent, yeah, or
yeah.
You know, with others we love as well. It's only natural to, particularly with little ones, you know, it's like,
But, you know, I'm not going to worry about being taken over by aliens.
Yeah, that's one thing. Maybe relax.
You know,
about.
I'm just not going to worry about that.
Right.
Because
a few other things.
I think, there might be things worth worrying about for sure, but you know.
Well, it shows how fertile our imaginations can be.
Right.
For better or worse.
Well, we
for better or worse.
We all know that because we were all children once and could imagine what was under the bed or behind the dark stairs as we were going up, or you know.
Right.
Your heart starts racing just from your own imagination. But
yeah,
anyway,
ghost fear. Think about ghost fear.
Yeah,
what a powerful
it's real.
Evolutionary influence that was. Yeah. Yeah.
And again, the Urantia book puts that into such perspective, right? It says, "Well, you know, you came from
the beginning
from
of religion."
Yeah,
right.
You came from that. You're evolving out of that, but it's still there. It still lingers somewhat. Because, you know, honestly, we haven't had the teachers that a normal world would have that would help us overcome some of that stuff. So we just have had to do it. Where you were saying last week, Chuck, it's the DIY planet. Yeah, it's
right.
True.
Yeah. But they point out, this is really interesting to me, they point out somewhere, I forget where, but this whole thing about ghost fear is it introduces the human mind to the idea of invisible presence.
Sure.
Which kind of, even though it creates fear, it's that seed that eventually develops into the willingness to accept the invisible presence of God. And that I just had never thought about that before. But yeah, I can see how evolutionarily that's like super important.
Yeah.
Well, it's always interesting when these things come up, and truth in advertising. I had no influence on this conversation for any of you that were in the UUI Cafe last night, where our topic was Paper 87, the ghost cults, ahead of Halloween. And so we were actually talking about a lot of this stuff that you were bringing up. You know, and what's interesting, you know, is one of the things that came up was this idea that the notion of two kinds of spirit ghosts made slow but sure progress throughout the world. This new dual spiritism did not have to spread from tribe to tribe. It sprang up independently all over the world.
Wow.
In influencing the expanding evolutionary mind, the power of an idea lies not in its reality or reasonableness, but rather in its vividness and the universality of its ready and simple application. It was literally, even at that stage, you know, it was an idea whose time had come in that sense. And
isn't that interesting?
It is. But here's also the interesting thing, because Chuck brought up the whole idea of the Caligastic thing. They talk about this having come up, and by the time they get to paragraph 7, and for those of you following and taking notes, 8747, so section 4, paragraph 7 in paper 87, the tragedy of all this, speaking about this idea of dual spiritism, lies in the fact that when these ideas were taking root in the primitive mind of man, there really were no bad or disharmonious spirits in all the world.
Wow.
Such a fortunate situation did not develop until after the Caligastic Rebellion, and only persisted, and this is important, until Pentecost. The concept of good and evil as cosmic coordinates is, even in the 20th century, very much alive in human philosophy. Most of the world's religions still carry this cultural birthmark of the long gone days of the emerging ghost cults.
Ooh,
that's
a cultural birthmark. Wow.
Yeah,
that's a great paragraph.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's why conversation about, you know, this whole, all of our conversations and what the Orange Book gives us is a plain and unvarnished look at who we are and how we are and why we are and how we got here. And that's the beauty of it, because once you see it, then you can start to understand it and say, okay, so many of these things that I might, you know, and especially here at the time when all the spook movies are on, and, you know, every year at Halloween, it's all we love to terrorize each other. And we should ask ourselves why we love to do that in the first place, you know, why we get so addicted to the adrenaline that we get from horror. And from horrifying things, but you know, here we are trying to cope, and whatever helps us cope in any way. Going back to the Desiderata, you know, don't distress yourself with imaginings. I say that to myself. I can't tell you how many times to remind myself: don't be distressed over something that isn't even real. You know, save your distress for something that's clear and present. And, you know, in some ways, I think if the Prince of Darkness wanted to claim a victory, he could claim it just by the fact that he's got us all riddled with fear and panic and dread. And there's nowhere to go with that.
Well,
you know,
the fact that he's got fundamentalist Christianity still talking about him and giving him a position almost equal with God.
Well, maybe
even
more powerful.
Giving the devil almost more power than God. I mean, that really, in a certain sense, fundamentalism really needs to be challenged that way. How can you, in the name of bringing adherence to your faith out of fear, which is really just using the techniques of the ghost cult, right?
Right.
that's how people were kept in line with ghost fear, right?
Yeah.
Well, using those primitive techniques of winning adherence to the faith, and in doing so, perpetuating the lie that Caligastia, that the devil is somehow almost as strong as God, Or maybe it's I mean it's an even deeper lie in the sense that, well, he's not as strong as God. We know that. But, you know, he's a lot closer to you than God is and trying to influence you all the time. Whereas God, well, God kind of winds things up and then just lets it go. And he's just watching from afar, you know. There's,
right.
I mean, that's still a present belief that God is really distant and really doesn't care, but the devil does. And he wants
you. The devil's right in your business.
That's right.
Oh, he'd love us to think that, wouldn't he? And in
yeah,
fact,
right.
He doesn't even believe in God. So, you know, he'd rather us believe, not even entertain the idea that there is a God. And I would say that in some ways they give him more power than God, because he seems all, the devil seems all powerful and God seems impotent. And for young people who are you know, looking and searching for something to, you know, and then you wonder why they go with this thing that you've seemed to given, you've given all the power to this. You know, you've said, well, this thing has all the power to do this and that with you. Well, this other person might help you, but you've got to beware of this other thing that has all the power, you know?
Mm.
I mean,
yeah.
Well,
that
people,
can,
I mean,
that
they're
can even
unwittingly.
Trick God. Yeah,
yeah,
that God has no power
God.
Over some app.
Right.
You know?
Right.
What?
Well, it creeps into entertainment, too. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And
there's
the
like
message
an undying
should
fascination.
Be.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there you go. It should
so,
be swapped, though. It should be just the opposite. God has all the power to protect you from anything. Anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know,
yeah.
You're going to, there's always going to be trouble in a material life. That's true. And God isn't about getting you out of all of the difficulties and the problems you have to solve. That's not God. God knows you, that's the way you grow and learn. But this other thing that you think, you know, is looming over you is not. And that is powerless
yeah.
before the
divinity well, the comment
that
about
lives within you.
Caligastia being servile in the presence of
yes,
the paradise.
Servile.
Servile,
right.
You know. So
yeah.
we personally
yeah.
are well protected, at least from him.
Yeah, right. That's it's the least we
well,
should be afraid of.
Be another matter.
This
yeah.
truth, to segue here a little bit, this truth must become firmly entrenched and foundational in the
yes.
minds of at least a strong leadership, if at first, if not the majority of human beings, if we're ever to make real strides toward, dare I say it, becoming a sphere
light
of
life.
Light and life. Oh!
Mm.
Oh, I,
how about
hey, I remember what
space.
The topic was of this particular show.
maybe the key is that we need to start focusing on light and life instead of on darkness and death. You know,
yes.
that to me it's just really simple. All of our media and our movies and whatnot are all focused on darkness and death. And not, you know, very few are on light and life. Every once in a while, you know, when they make children's movies or movies with for families, they focus them on light and life. But very few stories that we tell each other are about that. And
yeah.
maybe that it's just as simple as changing our focus from darkness and death to light and life. You know, just
well.
That simple.
You know, and just getting to that first or planetary stage
yes.
would be wonderful. And what would that be
yeah,
like, I wonder?
Well,
we
can
that?
Read.
Oh, okay. How about that?
Who wants to read that, Section 7, the first or planetary stage?
I'll be glad to
yeah.
start.
Okay.
Sure.
And then, Chuck, you take the next one, and that'll...
All right.
Very good. The first or planetary stage, we're in Section 7 of Paper 55. This epoch extends from the appearance of the Marantia Temple at the new planetary headquarters to the time of the settling of the entire system in light and life. This age is inaugurated by the Trinity Teacher Sons at the close of their successive world missions, when the planetary prince is elevated to the status of planetary sovereign by the mandate and personal presence of the paradise bestowal son of that sphere. Concomitant therewith, the finaliters inaugurate their active participation in planetary affairs. To outward and visible appearances, the actual rulers or directors of such a world settled in light and life are the material son and daughter, the planetary Adam and Eve. The finaliters are invisible, as also is the prince sovereign, except when in the Marantia temple. The actual and literal heads of the planetary regime are therefore the material son and daughter. It is the knowledge of these arrangements that has given prestige to the idea of kings and queens throughout the universe realms. And kings and queens are a great success under these ideal circumstances when a world can command such high personalities to act in behalf of still higher but invisible rulers. When such an era is attained on your world, no doubt, Machiavento Melchizedek, now the vicegerent planetary prince of Urantia, will occupy the seat of the planetary sovereign. And it has long been conjectured on Gerasim that he will be accompanied by a son and daughter of the Urantia Adam and Eve, who are now held on Edentia as wards of the Most Highs of Norlaishadek. These children of Adam might so serve on Urantia in association with the Melchizedek sovereign, since they were deprived of procreative powers almost 37,000 years ago, at the time they gave up their material bodies on Urantia in preparation for transit to Edentia. This settled age continues on until every inhabited planet in the system attains the era of stabilization. And then, when the youngest world, the last to achieve light and life, has experienced such settledness for one millennium of system time, the entire system enters the stabilized status, and the individual worlds are ushered into the system epoch of the era of light and life.
So that's the first. It begins with the individual planets, just like it begins with each individual. We are all
right.
on a journey toward light and life, right? We're all on the same journey, individually and collectively. We're all headed in that direction.
Yeah.
But there's some interesting prophecies in this section, aren't there? I mean,
what strikes you?
Well, when such an era is attained on your world, no doubt Machiavento Melchizedek, now the vicegerent planetary prince of Urantia, will occupy the seat of the planetary sovereign. And it has long been conjectured on Gerasim that he will be accompanied by a son and daughter of the Urantia Adam and Eve, who are now held on Edentia as wards of the Most Highs of Norlaishadek. These children of Adam might so serve on Urantia in association with the Melchizedek sovereign, since they were deprived of procreative powers almost 37,000 years ago, at the time they gave up their material bodies on Urantia in preparation for transit to Edentia. Now, who are they, because are they saying that these children of Adam and Eve might come back and serve as biologic uplifters again? Or are they saying, no, that's not going to happen?
No, they're not talking about biologic uplift. They are talking about administrative co-ruling with the Melchizedek sovereign. And that's all kind of fascinating. And why the sense? Why the contingency as though, if they hadn't been, that wouldn't be possible is almost the implication. These children of Adam might so serve on Urantia since they were deprived of procreative powers.
Oh,
is
yeah.
some of how you can diagram that, taking out the in association with Melchizedek sovereign clause, and get that put together, and then all of a sudden you're saying, huh, mm-hmm. why that?
Yeah, I was wondering
sequitur?
About that too.
Yeah. So
why would that matter?
Yes, and so
they were deprived
that's a curiosity.
Of an essential experience, is what that's telling me. They were deprived of an essential experience, and they correct me if I'm wrong. They're not. They were removed from the planet, but they're not ascending beings like their parents are now, are they? They're still.
Well, not yet. No, they're still material sons, effectively.
Right.
They are still of the order of material sons. Well, no, they're not. Sorry. They were born here. They were
right.
born here. So they were children of the violet race, okay? But there's still this sort of strange in-between status because they're not being treated like normal human children. Normal human
right.
children would have just been allowed to live and die. But these children
and
of Adam and Eve, right, these children of Adam and Eve that were members of the violet race, these were taken up to Edentia and have been ever since wards of the Most High. I mean, clearly they were raised up there, but they've long since reached adulthood, 37,000 years ago, and they have been still growing in that culture and no doubt serving and preparing in ways that we have no idea about, and perhaps
right.
they don't have fully an idea as to how they are going to be used. But it's a very interesting supposition on the part of our author here, who is a mighty messenger, who's part of the Archangel Council temporarily.
Mm-hmm. So he's not saying
Adam and
everything.
Adam and Eve themselves are part of the Council of 24, right?
Right, right.
Yes, they are.
Yep.
So they're closely involved with
and
the
may even
in
be.
This world.
Have recently or soon to be resident governors general of this world. You know, very much, the point is very much involved with our welfare.
Yeah, almost certainly
yeah.
they both have already been
governor general. Yeah.
You know, almost certainly. Mm-hmm. I mean,
almost
it's a probability of 17% that they have not been.
Right.
And we're about to change to the 21st governor general here in just 9 years, a little less than 9 years. And that you know, so we've almost gone through all 24, the 16 and the 8 temporary members of the Council of 24, which is another rabbit hole we won't go down. I'm always fascinated.
Mm-hmm.
Who are those other 8?
Me too. But then they have it.
Because they all have
it's
to be.
Like they keep
all have
a floating
to have died
sea.
Before the resurrection. You know, in order
right.
to qualify, they all have to have lived and died before the resurrection of Jesus on April 9th, 30 A.D. So that's fascinating to consider what 8 individuals from you know, history might be considered worthy temporary members. Are they other great teachers that maybe didn't make the contribution to the Supreme that the 16 did, but made sufficient contribution that they're held there? And you have to wonder, is Gautama Siddhartha, is Lao Tse, is, you know...
Explain, though, why it's a prerequisite for them to have been resurrected in a dispensational roll call and not on the third day. And that, you know, are you saying that nobody...
No. I don't mean that they were resurrected in the dispensational roll call. It is a prohibition ever to go back to your world during the current dispensation.
There you go.
And that means there's nobody, no former human being, and it's only rare. It's only in needing to serve in a, you know, in a relatively important position that is even allowed. And so it's only the Council of 24 that is allowed to come here, and none of them were alive during this post-bestowal son dispensation or the post-Michael dispensation here that began on April 9th, 30 AD.
Well, so do you think that they have...
That disallows any kind of, you know...
Right.
Visiting, you know, talking with your mom and dad and that kind of thing. Visiting
or Martin Luther
seances
King or
and,
Gandhi or...
Yeah. Gandhi, yeah, or any of... Yeah, in terms of the leadership, none of those kinds of leaders would be allowed to be part of the temporary core at this point, because
I wonder if
they're
an ad hoc committee though.
Well, they might be. They might be in the wings,
that.
Getting prepared.
Yeah,
you know, whoever it is that has been identified, there could be people that have been identified, but they may also be waiting to see who the other candidates are that arise during this dispensation. And after all,
right.
There is no given length at this point for this dispensation.
Right.
It might be a very short one if a magisterial son age is inaugurated by the advent of a magisterial son with an epical revelation having just been given. Why would anybody expect a new revelation sooner than the next 1,000 to 5,000 years? You know, how long will it take for this to do its work? It may take root. It may only take root in the next 300 to 500 years. How much time will it take for it to fully flourish and to do the work it was intended to do to prepare the way for whatever the next dispensation is to be?
Seems like a lot has to happen. To me.
Yeah.
Well, maybe some of those seats are being held open until after this dispensation.
That's a good point. Maybe they
right.
are.
I don't know.
Well, they do indicate that. Four of them are for those that will come from this, post-bestowal sun age.
Mm-hmm.
So once this age is closed, there will be four that are permanently filled from that, and four of the others at least will rotate off. And maybe some others will rotate on. I don't know. It's hard to say. But then there are four that are kept open for other dispensations later on. And that's the long-term plan. But then there's the thought that Machaventa Melchizedek might seize the reins of power at any time. You know, one author says, at any day or hour, we look for Machaventa Melchizedek. Others think it won't happen until Michael comes again. So there's all kinds of speculation. Anyway, we're all over the map today.
Well, you know, it's funny though, because it's talking about our planet and where we have to go. You know, we're clearly, I mean, let's face it. It's telling us that our system won't get to go to the next era until we come on board at the very least. And there's probably other planets maybe just as bad off as we are. We're the problem child in the system, and it tells us that there might be a couple of others just as bad. And so they're waiting on us. It's not like there's any impatience. It's not a race, you know, their focus is on us to help us get to where we need to go. And to me, the interesting part is, when will we change our focus and start focusing on what we need to do to get to where we need to go? And I said it earlier, focusing on light and life instead of darkness and death. We're obsessed with darkness and death. And we have to change our raison d'etre, our joie de vivre, you know, to focusing on all the good that there is, and to enhancing that and bringing that out and drawing that out of each other. And so I think it's a worthy discussion to have, what, you know, all of the elements at play that are trying to get us here. And, you know, they point out again in paragraph two that how crucial Adam and Eve are to this whole saga, and how they become the pivotal connection between us and the universe, or any inhabited world in the universe. They are pivotal. You can't see the sun, the planetary, you know, sovereign.
Yeah.
Only in the temple, they mention. You know, which I couldn't help but have that visualization in my mind of going into the temple and seeing this being of light on a normal world, and how powerful that must be. But, mm-hmm. you know, and then they talk about kings and queens, and how they would have been, you know, they can be a great success if they're benevolent, if they're benign dictators, you know, and working on behalf of the higher and invisible rulers. But that has seldom happened on our world. Still, though, you know, it's possible. It could happen. I think of government on a neighboring planet. It happened in that government where the rulers became benevolent. And
actually did what was best for all, or at least one abdicated so that the other would have to. You know,
right.
they talk about there being a triumvirate and allowing that rulership under, you know, relatively benevolent leadership. You got to imagine the kind of wise self-sacrifice in that kind of a move. That's so anti-political. It's quite remarkable. You can hardly imagine many representatives or statespeople doing, you know, that kind of act on behalf of their constituents, relinquishing power for the good of the whole. That's
right. Voluntary.
Where have we seen that in history lately? Very seldom, and only at lower levels.
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that, because this idea of the Adam and Eve becoming the rulers, the actual and literal heads of the planet, they say, the fact that it's a male-female partnership that's fulfilling that position is kind of so helpful in terms of understanding gender politics, if you will.
Sure.
They've each demonstrated the kind of sacrifice you're talking about, but maybe in a kind of a different way, in the sense that they are actually the parents of, you know, progeny.
All of these children.
Biologically mixed with the races of the world. So they have this not only a rulership or authority relationship, they also have a parental relationship. And that has this complemental male-female cooperation, standard of cooperation at the center of that, which would be such a wonderful influence on planetary affairs. I mean, that'd be so helpful for men and women of the world.
Wouldn't it, though?
To have that high example to look to for the kinds of, you know, what do they say about gender? It's maybe antagonistic to the individual, but yet it still perpetuates the race, or, you know, and then it has all these positive aspects that grow out of that. But to see an example of how to overcome that, what can seem like a gulf when you have complementary person, you know, a type of being that's in this sort of dual nature, you know, complemental, you know, like male and female, that, you know, we struggle with that so much because we don't have a good example of that. The turn to,
it's so true.
So
you know,
that,
in
I
a way,
is,
we've had our bestowal son, and you know, just the natural attraction of opposite sexes means that every woman that opens up her heart to this amazing son, this Jesus, this Michael of Nebadon, this, you know, this high and beautiful being who is a male, who was born as a male of our realm, and it was the epitome of maleness and the epitome of benevolent strength and loving strength and kindness and goodness. And it's so easy for a woman to fall in love with him. Our good friend Shoshone used to say, once you take Jesus as your lover, all the others are your brother. and there's truth to that. You know, it always elicited a laugh from me too, because your little heart becomes so overwhelmed with the goodness of this majestic male strength and beauty and the truth of it and the power of it. And but men, on the other hand, don't have that equivalent, which they would have had. I mean, we all would have had the same thing if there were a father and a mother on this world, a god and a goddess of Urantia.
All the guys would be in love with Eve.
They would. They'd all, and she would
be
the axiom, the axiom of feminine grace and beauty and strength and goodness and gentility and, you know, all of the wonderful things about femininity would be the, you know, would find their apex in her, and men would have that, and women then would have Adam. We'd have a mother and a father, and it's only natural. You know, I mean, when I was a little girl, my grandmother would tell me about my dad when he was little, and my heart would just melt. It's like, I want to know him then. I, you know, and I'd look at pictures of him when he was young and in his sailor uniform. you know, he was my axiom. And that's just so natural. And so part of the deprivation of our world is that we don't have both the god and the goddess. And it's hard to imagine the goddess. You know, it's easier to imagine the god because we had Jesus. It's much harder to imagine the goddess. So
well,
that's a deficit. I don't know how we overcome it, but it's a deficit.
It truly is. I mean, at least the Urantia book gives us some idea of the relationship between Jesus and his mother, with Mary, you know, and how they work side by side and raising the family and all the other kids. So even though there are, you know, issues there too.
With
Mary
which
not
is
fully
why...
understanding his nature, but at least the Urantia book gives us that, which is we see Jesus in a fatherly role. Partnering, it happens to be his own mother, but still, that partnership, parental partnership, just as real under those circumstances as any. So we do have
well,
that.
Well, I mean,
you
can definitely see the archetype of the divine mother having arisen. You know, in this is why the Catholic Church has beatified, you know, Mary, the Mother of God.
Yeah. I get
You know, it comes in dual form, both from the mystery cults, which had a Mother of God cult prior to Christianity, and so they absorbed that pagan cult, so-called pagan cult, into the stream of Christianity on the one hand, but that's almost like saying that's the subconscious element. The superconscious element is having Mary, the Mother of God, as a stand-in for the creative mother spirit. You know, there is a
and
Mother
Eve,
of God
too.
Cult in the and Eve, as well who would have, as Paula was pointing out, would have stood as emblematic of that that creative spirit principle in the universe.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. So
the divine feminine.
Yeah.
Like an intuitive longing for that that we all have.
Yeah.
It's kind of built in.
And even in the loving embrace of partners, true marital partners, a male and a female who belong together and complement each other in every way and work together for the good of the family, and just such a, you know, it wouldn't just be the axiom of maleness and femaleness, it would be the axiom of partnership between the two.
Yeah.
And we'd have that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'd have that as well as a forever example of how when a male and a female come together in true and loving partnership, what amazing and grand things can come of that. And but we don't have that either. So no wonder we struggle with marriage. Right?
That maps to deity, like you're just saying, Andre, about the mother spirit. You know, we see it demonstrated in its human form, and then that maps to deity. We can understand how deity and mother and father principles in play also.
Right. Well, it's quite a deficit on our world, and it always strikes me that's one of the things we have to overcome, and that's a big one.
Yeah.
Well, and, of course, you know, it's not going to be easy to overcome that.
But that's one of the major you might say, revelations within the Urantia book is this idea of parental deity that has both, you know, father and mother.
Right. True.
That's put,
that God
put
is
forward
both.
Just straight ahead, you know. In the Trinity, we see it with the Supreme, with the Universal Father, we see it in the local universe. Everywhere where there's creativity going on, there's a complemental relationship at the basis of it. Mm-hmm. And it's actually threefold. You carry it all the way. I mean, there's the mother, father, and child. So,
right.
Like the three
result.
Persons of the Trinity, and Jesus, and all that. But anyway, but the deity, the God concept in the Urantia book is an evolution beyond monotheism. And that might be problematic. For
Good
people.
Point. Well, it
but
is for the Muslim
important.
World, for sure.
Well, and
yeah.
Judaism, too. Judaism is strictly monotheistic.
Right.
Very much like Islam. So, but it opens up so much to have that understanding of the. It's one thing to say God is the Father, but God has a mother there too. They work together,
right?
It's that co-creative partnership.
It's the threefold.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Right. Right.
You know, clearly we have to get this marriage thing fixed on our world, so that we can advance. And one of my favorite quotes on this topic is from paper 84, section 6, paragraph 8. It says, marriage is the mother of all human institutions, for it leads directly to home founding and home maintenance, which is the structural basis of society. The family is vitally linked to the mechanism of self-maintenance. It is the sole hope of race perpetuation under the mores of civilization, while at the same time it most effectively provides certain highly satisfactory forms of self-gratification. And here's the statement that just always gets me. The family is man's greatest purely human achievement. Combining as it does the evolution of the biologic relations of male and female with the social relations of husband and wife. The reason that statement gets me is because I wonder what they're saying. Are they saying that, and this is how I understand it. They're saying that we came upon this ourselves without having Adam and Eve here. And that's why the fact that we decided to come together as men and women and create families is our greatest purely human achievement. That we did that ourselves. Talk about the DIY planet, you know. We figured that one out. The importance of family. We established that. We established it. And every culture on Earth established it. How important it is. So that's our greatest purely human achievement. That's the way I understand that. And, you know, clearly we have to shore it up and keep it strong. You know, somehow, some way.
It's a very strong statement, especially when you put it up against maybe other kinds of human achievements.
Right.
That one stands forward for so many reasons.
As our greatest purely human achievement, the greatest one.
Yeah.
We figured it out. We did it.
that level of cooperative creativity involves so much to make that happen.
Right. Right.
It's like,
So that's one we could maybe low-hanging fruit. Not that it would be an easy one, but it doesn't seem to me like it would. I think thinking about Government on a Neighboring Planet again, it may take 70 years or 100 years to really educate young people on how to pick the right partner for themselves, on the value of that partnership and the value of family life, and really educate them on being careful.
Yeah, other cultures have done a lot more with that, it seems like.
But it would start to bear fruit within a short while, relatively,
a
few generations.
They comment. I mean, there should actually be training, classes you take, and how to have a successful relationship even. Let alone how to maintain a marriage and have kids and raise them right. I mean, that should be a major topic of study. All the everything related to that, including relationships.
Unfortunately, it's all undermined by the fact that one person's view of how that should happen is countered by another person's view. And, we have major societal factions at odds with one another. At least in American culture, that would disallow that immediately, would say, who are you to tell me how to raise my kids?
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah. Or how to treat my wife.
Who are you to tell me
who
I should pick, how I should pick a partner and all of that?
But there's a way to soften it a little bit. So it's more like, let's talk about it at least, Let's look at
examples. Unfortunately,
yes.
In my view, America is plagued with what I would call societal Tourette's. If you tell me to do something, I have to do the opposite. There's probably 30 to 40% of the people in this culture, because we are made up of so many people that were escaping circumstances, either through the individualism that individual represented, or that was being oppressed by some kind of societal force where they were coming from.
Right.
And we're a whole culture made up of that.
Yeah.
And and so it's almost ingrained in the American psyche to be that way. And it's a handicap, frankly, to societal progress. You cannot have a society that progresses where social responsibilities are held to be less important than individual rights.
Right.
Mm. Yeah.
There you go.
Well, and also
our friend,
I
just wanted to say Charles Olivier used to point that out a lot, but go ahead, Chuck.
I mean, just the whole thing with gender difference. And gender issues in general. It's become so confused and dogmatic from another direction, really. You don't believe it.
True.
Men and women aren't the same.
It's the pendulum swinging the other way, isn't it?
Yeah,
It goes from these oppressive gender roles to now all anything goes, and I don't know, you don't even know what to call a person anymore, He, she, or it, you just don't know. And
everybody's got those pronouns.
Yeah, right. We're in a stage of confusion about it. I mean, hopefully the pendulum will start to come back the other way and it'll balance out a little bit and it won't be so weird and unusual that, it'll start to make more sense again. But here's another great quote about family life. And this is from Paper 83, Section 7, Paragraph 6. It says, "The real test of a marriage, all down through the ages, has been that continuous intimacy which is inescapable in all family life. Two pampered and spoiled youths, educated to expect every indulgence," here's your rights, Andre, "educated to expect every indulgence and full gratification of vanity and ego, can hardly hope to make a great success of a marriage and home building, a lifelong partnership of self-effacement, compromise devotion and unselfish dedication to child culture. I think they really they really throw it down right there and say, so here you go.
Yeah.
If you want your children to make good marriages, don't educate them to expect every indulgence and full gratification of vanity and ego. You know, and we certainly see a lot of that going on now where everybody wants to be a YouTube star, you know, and that's the way they think they can contribute to the world culture rather than just going out and getting, you know, a meaningful occupation or career that really does contribute to world culture.
I don't know. There's a lot of people on YouTube. They're pretty cool. I mean, I like the idea that any individual can have a voice.
I agree.
There's,
with that.
You know, but yeah, it can, you know, it can go too far maybe sometimes. But
yeah, and it's like anything, isn't it? Anything can be like that. And we're certainly in the early stages of that phenomenon, that social media phenomenon, and we're going through the growing the horrible growing pains of that, of what we're communicating to each other, you know. But
this idea that an individual can just, like, out of nowhere communicate with the whole planet almost is like, that's an evolutionary, emerging evolutionary reality that nowhere close to that at any time in the past.
True.
So that's creating all kinds of new issues, opportunities, problems,
opportunities,
all kinds of things that hopefully can be managed to the good.
Right. But they kind of tell you in that paragraph, too, that what is marriage? It's a lifelong partnership of self-effacement, compromise, devotion, and unselfish dedication to child culture. There you go. Each generation has to focus on the next one coming up in order to shore it up for the future, for the coming, you know, next 50 years or whatever. And that's the focus. The focus isn't on self. It's on them so that they can make the world a better place. They are the legacy. Our children are. So it's, it's quite...
But meanwhile, the world is changing so fast.
Right, right. Helping
for
them
the
navigate
parents
that.
To keep up with that. Parents to keep up with that so they can be effective and even warning their children about what's out there.
Right.
It's a challenge. It's a challenge.
When it's also new to all of us, really.
We're all
this age of communication.
Sometimes the kids catch on fast from the parents with certain things.
Right, right. Which they do.
I don't know.
Well,
but
shall
value,
we keep going?
The value
let's keep going.
The value level is what doesn't change. And that's
right, and that's what
shouldn't change. Can come into play. Right.
Regardless those core values.
Right.
Absolutely. Unselfish devotion is one of them, you know, dedication.
Exactly.
Those core values that we bring to play,
those
should always stay the same.
Endure.
And they should endure. We want to preserve
them. They really, they establish the standard
for
how to be a person. Anyway.
Well, go ahead, Chuck.
Should we go on to the next one?
Yeah, take her away, Let's read section 7.
Okay, we're moving on. This is the second or the system stage. So the first stage got us up to the system level. I mean, it carried on until the whole system is settled in my mind. Now we're going to see what happens next. When an entire system becomes settled in life, a new order of government is inaugurated. Planetary sovereigns become members of the system conclave. Mm-hmm. And this new administrative body, subject to the veto of the Constellation Fathers, is supreme in authority. Such a system of inhabited worlds becomes virtually self-governing. The system legislative assembly is constituted on the headquarters world, which would be Garrison, right? And each planet sends its 10 representatives there too. courts are now established on the system capitals, and only appeals are taken to the universe, and only appeals are taken to the universe headquarters. With the settling of the system, the assigned sentinel, representative of the super universe supreme executive, this is the kind of administrative stuff I was referring to earlier, mm-hmm. all these different beings, right?
Right.
With the settling of the system, the assigned sentinel, representative of the super universe supreme executive, becomes the volunteer advisor to the system supreme court, an actual presiding officer of the new legislative assembly. Mm-hmm. After the settling of an entire system in light and life, the system sovereigns will no more come and go. Such a sovereign remains perpetually at the head of his system. The assistant sovereigns continue to change as in former times. Mm-hmm. During this epoch of stabilization, for the first time, Midsoniters come from the universe headquarters worlds of their sojourn to act as counselors to the legislative assemblies and advisors to the adjudicational tribunals. These Midsoniters also carry on certain efforts to inculcate new motu meanings of supreme value into the teaching enterprises, which they sponsor jointly with the finaliters. What the material sons did for the mortal races biologically, the Midsonite creatures now do for these unified and glorified humans in the ever-advancing realms of philosophy and spiritualized thinking.
Wow.
Mm. On the inhabited worlds, the teacher sons become voluntary collaborators with the finaliters. And these same teacher sons also accompany the finaliters to the mansion worlds when those spheres are no longer to be utilized as differential receiving worlds after an entire system is settled in light and life. At least this is true by the time the entire constellation has thus evolved. But there are no groups that far advanced in Nebadon. So this is all kind of projection. We are not permitted to reveal the nature of the work of the finaliters who will supervise such rededicated mansion worlds. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, the future purpose of mansion worlds. You have, however, been informed that there are throughout the universe various types of intelligent creatures who have not been portrayed in these narratives. Whoa. And now, as the systems, one by one, become settled in light by virtue of the progress of their component worlds, the time comes when the last system in a given constellation attains stabilization, and the universe administrators, the master sun, the union of days, and the bright and morning star, that would be Emmanuel and Gabriel, right? Michael,
and
Emmanuel,
Jesus.
And Gabriel?
Yeah, right.
Well, that would be Michael. Yeah, Michael, Emmanuel.
Yeah,
Gabriel.
Michael, yeah.
These three beings arrive on the capital of the constellation to proclaim the Most Highs, the unqualified rulers of the newly perfected family of 100 settled systems of inhabited worlds.
Wow.
Huh.
So
what?
Are they saying that there's no such situation like that in Nebadon right now in our universe?
Not yet.
That's correct.
Not yet. Right.
We're too young yet.
We're too young. Okay. But we're
much too young.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
We've got we certainly have a capable sovereign at the helm, so
mm-hmm.
as all I'm sure universes do, but what you know came to me as you were reading this, Chuck, was Jesus saying, declaring that he who is last. No, let's see. No, that's not the one. What came to me was him saying, to all who have, more shall be added. while to him who has not, even that which he has shall be taken away. And it, that seems to me to be a universe pattern. When you achieve more, you are given more to help you achieve more. And it happens in, you know, progressive stages. So here we see that now we've achieved this. Now the mid-sonators come and help us achieve even more. They do for, they would do what the material sons and daughters did, only to help us with our ever-advancing realms of philosophy and spiritualized thinking. So, you know, to him who has, even more shall be given. They're giving us even more. And it's like the whole universe is ever ready, the whole universe of universes, ever ready to take us to the next step, whatever that is, you know, whatever that growth entails.
Yeah.
Fabulous, actually.
Well, it follows a pattern. This is a quote that came up in the last podcast Derek and I did. I love this quote where it says, this is paper 1, section 4, paragraph 5. The God of universal love unfailingly manifests himself to every one of his creatures up to the fullness of that creature's capacity to spiritually grasp the qualities of divine truth, beauty, and goodness. So that principle, if you want to call it that, seems to play out on every level, including planetary system. Yeah. That there's
here again is another pattern that is woven throughout the book, as Andre pointed out at the beginning of the show, that they keep showing us from different angles, you know, how that works out, how that works out.
As capacity grows, spirit rushes in.
Right.
It's amazing to know that because it kind of creates a new kind of motivation almost to want that, know that that's in our individual potential, but it's also in the planetary potential and all of our associations and friendships and projects and everything else, that that principle will hold true. So that's why we can, you know, why it's important to look to God, right?
Right.
For guidance in all of this, because that's how that's going to happen.
To truly seek that divine guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you make of the sixth paragraph? That sixth paragraph is a killer.
Yeah. It's always when they are giving us a tidbit like that, you know, that's, again, completely, it's 90 degrees to anything else we're looking at. They're all of a sudden saying, you might consider this as an unusual feature of progress, and it's outside of the stream of normal mortal progression. What do you think of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this idea about various types of creatures has not been portrayed, not been revealed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not surprising that that would be the case, but interesting that that would come into play when the mansion worlds are repurposed, essentially. I think it's what they're talking about there, right? They no longer, their former purpose is no longer needed as transition spheres of mortal ascension. So they take on some other purpose that involves the finaliters, the supervision of the finaliters. So I don't know. It's just like we're not permitted, of course. They're not permitted, of course, to reveal that, even though they just told us.
Well sometimes it's what they don't say.
They don't reveal the nature of the work.
Right.
But
then this is what's intriguing to me about that. It says, you have, however, been informed that there are throughout the universes various types of intelligent creatures who have not been portrayed in these narratives.
Right.
Okay. So, but finaliters have. So what are they getting at there?
Yeah.
That's a different bag for me a bit.
You know, the only kind of clue that that occurs to me is some of the clues that are given in the personality classifications that are in paper 30. where literally in Personalities of the Grand Universe, they go through these personality classifications. And when they get to the ascending orders, you know, they talk about triune origin beings. Well, none of those are ascending that we know. Well, there are probably some that are ascending, but they are triune by virtue of trinitization and some other things. Then they mm-hmm. get into these other things, unrevealed sons of God in the descending orders, okay? And then unrevealed mm-hmm. dual origin beings in the stationary orders. And then in the ascending orders, unrevealed ascenders. Mm-hmm. What? Adjuster-fused
wow.
mortals, sun-fused mortals, spirit-fused mortals, translated midwares, unrevealed ascenders. What?
Mm.
Then
yeah.
single origin beings further down the ascending orders, personalized adjusters, ascending material sons, evolutionary seraphim, evolutionary cherubim, unrevealed ascenders. So there are at least two classes of unrevealed ascenders that we have no knowledge of. They are disclosed generally in this way, and they are disclosed as single origin and dual origin, but they're clearly leaving this up to our speculation, and they're disclosing it to us so that we can make a beginning at thinking about it as part of our universe cosmology and philosophy that would help us to get a bigger picture. You know, these are all puzzle pieces that they intend for us to get some better idea as to what the universe is really like. But part of that is expanding the picture. You know, you can only look generally. I love to use this. I overuse this analogy that, you know, you generally search for your keys, not where you drop them, but where the light is, right? You can't go about searching for your keys in the dark corner where you might have lost them. So you tend to look for where the light is, and only if you've got a flashlight are you capable of looking around. But the same thing is true here. If it's not revealed or even disclosed, it's really hard to think about it. Here they're giving us some kind of idea that, okay, here is a place where you might consider looking. Are these unrevealed ascenders of single origin or of dual origin? And that's just fascinating. That's fascinating.
Well, you know, there's so many just mysterious statements in the Urantia book that are similar to that. And one that comes to mind while you were talking, Andre, is this one from paper 13, section 1, paragraph 20. It's the secrets of Seraphington involve mm-hmm. a threefold mystery, only one
that
of which
one too,
I may
right?
mention. The mystery of seraphic transport, the ability of various orders of seraphim and allied spirit beings to envelop within their spirit forms all orders of non-material personalities and to carry them away on lengthy interplanetary journeys is a secret locked up in the sacred sectors of Seraphington. The transport seraphim comprehend this mystery, but they do not communicate it to the rest of us, or perhaps they cannot. The other mysteries of Seraphington pertain to the personal experiences of types of spirit servers as yet not revealed to mortals. And we mm-hmm. refrain from discussing the secrets of such closely related beings because you can almost comprehend such near orders of existence. Sorry about the phone.
Yeah.
And it says you can almost comprehend such near orders of existence, and it would be akin to a betrayal of trust to present even our partial knowledge of such phenomena. So I can't help but think that maybe they are also ascenders if they're that close to us.
Right.
And I think every Urantian is, you know, anybody who's ever read that has to ponder, so who are they talking about? And I've had some readers tell me, oh, they're talking about midwares. But it's like, no, they fully disclose midwares to us. So, you know, they're talking about something else here.
Right.
It's so intriguing, though.
Yeah, there is another statement. I'll go look for it. But go ahead, Chuck, that alludes
I thought it might be fun
to what maybe.
Just read it.
Is that the one you about to talk about that? Go ahead.
No, I just thought
I don't have it pulled up yet.
Paragraphs about the Midsonite beings.
Okay, go ahead.
Because they're also very, very mysterious and intriguing. So, I don't know, just a couple paragraphs where they talk about their origin and possible purpose.
Oh, good.
This is in paper 36, actually in the Life Carriers paper, which is intriguing. Paper 30, section 4, maybe I'll just read the first couple paragraphs and then the last one perhaps. But this is, they say that in every local system, we're reading about systems, of inhabited worlds, throughout Nepodon, there is a single sphere whereon the Melchizedeks have functioned, as life carriers. Okay? So this section is called Melchizedek Life Carriers. These abodes are known as the system Midsonite worlds, and on each of them, a materially modified Melchizedek son has mated with a selected daughter of the material order of sonship, meaning a material daughter. The mother Eves of such Midsonite worlds are dispatched from the system headquarters of jurisdiction, having been chosen by the designated Melchizedek life carrier from among the numerous volunteers who respond to the call of the system sovereign addressed to the material daughters of his sphere. Okay? So the Melchizedek picks one of these volunteers. The progeny of a Melchizedek life carrier and a material daughter are known as Midsoniters. The Melchizedek father of such a race of supernal creatures, these are material parentage. I don't know about the Midsoniters themselves, but the Melchizedek father of such a race of supernal creatures eventually leaves the planet of his unique life function, and the Mother Eve of this special order of universe beings also departs upon the appearance of the seventh generation of planetary offspring. The direction of such a world then devolves upon her eldest son. And there's a bunch of other interesting stuff in that section. Now, let me just read the last paragraph. They say, the purpose of the Midsonite creatures is not at present known. But it would appear that these personalities are foregathering on the seventh finality world in preparation for some future eventuality in universe evolution. Our inquiries concerning the Midsonite races are always referred to the finaliters. And always do the finaliters decline to discuss the destiny of their wards. Regardless of our uncertainty as to the future of the Midsoniters, we do know that every local universe in Orbiton harbors such an accumulating core of these mysterious beings. It is the belief of the Melchizedek life carriers that their Midsonite children will someday be endowed with the transcendental and eternal spirit of Ipsonity by God the Ultimate.
Wow.
So in terms of what we just read, that kind of opens up a whole new kind of picture where, you know, it's probably what they're talking about is the mansion worlds are going to serve a different purpose in the age of the Ultimate. I mean, you're going to have the pilgrims streaming in from the outer space level, and they're going to, what were formerly the mansion worlds will serve some new kind of purpose. During the next universe age.
Right. Which we don't think about right normally until they mention that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah,
right.
They'll have to repurpose them at that point. What will their purpose be?
Right.
Right.
So in this, what we just read, they talk about the finaliters and the Midsoniters and all of that. You know, they're going to be playing a role somehow in this new function.
Right. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because they do say, and there's another pattern there, and that is that always, you know, this idea that there's a higher authority that comes down to advise, you know, in an advisory mm-hmm. capacity, just like Emmanuel mm-hmm. with Michael, you know, on the universe level, there's always this advisor provided that serves.
Yeah, right, you were right. Yeah, we do see that over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, over and over again, where there's a higher advisor that's serving in that capacity, in a capacity as, you know,
mm-hmm.
the wisdom of the higher realm. Fascinating. And, you know, just back at that paragraph that mentions the Mid-Sinaiters, it says, paragraph 4, during this epoch of stabilization, for the first time, Mid-Sinaiters come from the universe headquarters world to their sojourn to act as counselors to the legislative assemblies and advisors to the adjudicational tribunals. These Mid-Sinaiters also carry on certain efforts to inculcate new moda meanings of supreme value into the teaching enterprises which they sponsor jointly with the Finaliters. Fascinating
mm-hmm.
creatures.
Yeah.
Yeah. It goes on to
so
say what they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're talking about this planet. They're talking about an individual world in that paragraph,
right?
Not the system.
Right.
Right. So I wonder, given the nature of their origin, you know, a materialized Melchizedek life carrier and a material daughter, that they would be material beings of some sort. I mean, sounds like.
Well, yes.
Which is my guess.
Yeah.
So that means that they could be visible. When they come to serve on this world, they could be visible, whereas the Finaliters are not.
Right, yes.
Mm-hmm. So
maybe
that might provide a tremendous advantage in terms of the teaching efforts that they describe here.
I'm so glad you read about their origin, because they're clearly a hybrid being, right, Andre? What do you think about that? Would they be visible?
Well, yeah, they're clearly material creatures, and that's underscored by the fact of how they describe them. You know, they never die. Okay,
right.
They have a lifespan of 1,000 standard years, and when they mean standard years, they mean local universe years, and that's approximately 5 years, and so that's 5,000 years that they are living and never die, and are on their world, participating in their civilization. Now imagine what kind of a civilization grows up when a child can grow up and live for 5,000 years.
Wow.
And then at the end of those, you know, 1,000 standard years, those 5,000 years, they are translated from among the living. In other words, they never die. Mm-hmm. They end their life by translating into a non-material spirit form, you know, or whatever form that is, as Mid-Sinaite creatures, you know, exactly whether it may have a Marantia aspect, it may have, who knows, but they translate, they go and serve on the systems for a little while, and then eventually congregate on the local universe Mid-Sinaite sphere, which is one of the spheres surrounding, you know, in the Finaliter cluster, surrounding the local universe headquarters, surrounding Salvington.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's what we know a little bit more. But they're effectively, they don't know whether to class them as mortal or immortal, because
yeah,
they never die.
Paragraph 4. Yeah, it might be worth just reading that. That was in that same section.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead and read it.
Well, okay. So, yeah, it's two paragraphs. I mean, everything you're saying is exactly right. But here's where it just kind of fills in the detail. So maybe the third and fourth paragraph of that same section 4 in paper 36. They say the Mid-Sinaite creatures live and function as reproducing beings. So, I mean, they must be like sexually reproducing on their magnificent world until they are 1,000 standard years of age, whereupon they are translated by seraphic transport. Midsoniters are non-reproducing beings thereafter because the technique of dematerialization, which they pass through in preparation for enseraphiming, forever deprives them of reproductive prerogatives. And that parallels what we were just reading about the children of Adam and Eve, who may come back to this world.
Interesting.
The same would be true for them. And then they say, paragraph 4, the present status of these beings can hardly be reckoned as either mortal or immortal. This is Andre was saying, neither can they be definitely classified as human or divine. These creatures are not adjuster indwelt, hence hardly immortal. But neither do they seem to be mortal. No Midsonider has experienced death. All Midsoniders ever born in Ebedon are alive today, functioning on their native world, on some intervening sphere, or on the Salvington Midsonite sphere in the Finaliter's group of worlds.
Yeah.
So
now, just imagine
one of those wild cards.
Yeah, just imagine one feature of that, okay? In 5,000 years of life, regardless of what activities they've been part of, they've never gotten sick and died. They've never had an accident and died. Okay?
Yeah.
Just try to get your mind wrapped around that one.
Yeah. I've wondered about that with Amidon in particular. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Now that's pretty fascinating.
Even their name holds a clue because you've got, finaliters, and midsoniters.
Mm-hmm.
So, and later on in this paper in section 10, it's going to tell us that they're reckoned as one of the orders of permanent citizenship. Isn't that interesting? Permanent citizenship. Such as material sons, univitatia, midsoniters, sustatia, and spirit-fused mortals. So they're reckoned in that order of permanent citizenship, which, again, is another pattern. Always is there the permanent, the stability is always provided. That creates stability, continuity, those permanent citizens, whatever realm, they create the continuity.
Yeah.
And the anchor, the stability.
Well, you're just saying there, Andre, about their ability to live for such a long time, apparently damage-free, right? They make
apparently
a similar comment. A similar comment about Amidon. Let me just read this. It says, Van was left on, this is 6764. It's an interesting parallel to what we just read. 6764. They say Van was left on Urantia until the time of Adam, remaining as titular head of all superhuman personalities functioning on the planet. He and Amidon were sustained by the technique of the Tree of Life in conjunction with the specialized ministry of the Melchizedeks for over 150,000 years. So this comment about specialized ministry of the Melchizedeks could, the Melchizedek involvement in the creation of the Midsoniters and all of that.
Huh.
It's like, okay, maybe the Melchizedeks run the repair shop,
Yeah.
Because you got it.
Yeah,
indeed.
Amidon, for that length of time, on a wild and woolly planet, there's going to be some accidents. There's going to be some serious injuries. I don't see how there couldn't be.
You have to wonder. You have to just wonder
and try to imagine
what that could have been like. Well, in the same way that we're going to be fascinated by doing a life review of the life of the master here on Earth. I mean, that's one of those things that you can imagine that's a sort of Well, I call some of these Hodge moments, you know, that in our progression, especially coming from Urantia, there will be certain Hodge moments where we all go through them. And you can imagine that something that all individuals coming from Urantia want to do is once they learn and understand that their creator son became a master son through going through a seventh bestowal on their world, a review of the life of Jesus, if it's not compulsory, and I hesitate to even use that word, you know, it's definitely mm-hmm. something that every mortal ascender wants to do, if not before, mm-hmm. certainly after fusion. And I wonder when they place that and when they do that. Well, another one that would be interesting, I mean, we'll be surveying and learning about the history, not only of our world, but of all the worlds in the system before, you know, before we leave Jerusalem, maybe even before we get there, I'm not sure. Imagine that, you know, some of those seminal lives, biographies that we want to study might be things like the life of Van and the life of Amidon. Mm. And imagine surveying that life and then getting to know that. That's another fascinating one to want mm-hmm. to get to know. So I can imagine being in class with all you guys and with all of our listeners out there, you know, going through that. And that's like one of the sort of Hodge moments, you know, one of the things that we all like do.
It's like the equivalent of binge watching on Netflix.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, define Hodge moment for us.
In the Jesus.
Yeah,
series,
well, I just want to see that episode again.
Come on, one more day.
Yeah.
Well,
what's
the
Hodge,
Hodge
moment, Andre?
Well, the Hodge is the, you know, the Muslim, they're the seven pillars of, no, the five pillars of Islam, you know, and one is, you know, aside from like, you know, praying five times a day is one, and almsgiving is another, and, you know, there are others that are like that, but one is making the Hajj, which is the pilgrimage to Mecca and, you know, the trip to Medina and the whole thing that is wrapped around that.
Wow.
That's something that every Muslim aspires to do once in their lifetime. Okay. Well, I think there are those kinds of Hajj moments on our ascent. I think there's definitely for Urantia book readers, the Hajj of being a Urantia book reader is to do one complete sequential reading of the Urantia book. To me, that is the Hodge for Urantia book readers. And
okay,
why?
Great.
Mm-hmm. You know, paper 19 indicates that going from origin to destiny is an important aspect of our education, and that's clearly in section one of paper 19, you know, where they state that. And that implies, you know, and they talk about the revelation, you know, mortals would tend to like to go from man to God in this study. And that would lead to a certain kind of genetic knowledge, but not to spiritual wisdom.
Right.
Well, therefore, you know, something that I think many serious students of the Urantia book come to at some point is that at some point in either their dabbling or their study, and I skipped around all the time when I was a young reader, but when I came upon that and I understood that, it was clear that they were advocating a study from front to back of the Urantia book. And that even if I skipped around, what I ought to do is to come back to that place in my sequential reading and continue forward. And so that's why I refer to that as the Hodge for Urantia book readers. It's the one thing that if we do it, it makes a change, an indescribable change or maybe an undefinable change, but it changes both our level of study at
it's
the very least
experience.
At the bottom. But on the top mm-hmm. of it, it changes our appreciation of the universe, of God. It changes. It's an internal change. I call it essentially, in another sense, it's the full upload. You know, it
well,
is.
We're going to have to leave
well,
it there, also. Andre, because we're
oh,
out of
there. We're there. We're done.
That was good. The Hodge moment has left us out of time, but that's good. That was
okay.
a great place to leave it.
Yeah, right.
And so hold that thought, Chuck, until next week, because we have two more great sections coming up. And
yeah,
the pilgrimage.
Yes.
And it's great study, you guys. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I got so
yeah,
much
yeah.
out
it
of
fun.
It.
This was a lot of fun.
Okay. Yeah. Until next week.
Until next time, we'll take up with the constellation level.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
And
okay.
Go from there. We'll go from there.
All right.
All right, my
friends.
God bless. Love you, too.
Yep.
You, too.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.